The 24-karat gold wedding band was found sitting perfectly upright on the kitchen counter, exactly 3 inches from the edge of a puddle of congealing blood. It wasn't dropped, it was placed. The house at 412 Sycamore remains silent, the air heavy with the metallic tang of iron and the scent of burnt cinnamon toast. There are no signs of forced entry, no shattered glass, no splintered wood, only the low rhythmic thumping of a ceiling fan in the master bedroom, cutting through the stagnant air like a slow, steady heartbeat. On the mahogany dining table, 2 plates of half-eaten breakfast sit untouched. The coffee in the mugs is cold, a thin, oily film beginning to form on the surface. Everything looks normal, except for the fact that the woman who lived here is currently missing 40% of her skin. We are walking through the foyer now. Every step on the hardwood floor feels like an intrusion. To the left, a family portrait hangs slightly crooked, the glass reflecting the harsh glare of the forensic flashbulbs. To the right, the kitchen. This is where the physics of the crime defy logic. The blood on the floor is pooled in a way that suggests a slow, deliberate process, a medical precision that doesn't align with a crime of passion. Forensic technicians are currently dusting the gold ring for prints, but they already know what they'll find. Nothing, not a single smudge, not even a partial. The ring is cleaner than the day it was bought. And then there is the sound. Every 45 seconds, a high-pitched digital chirp echoes from somewhere behind the walls. It's the sound of a low battery in a smoke detector, a persistent, annoying reminder of a household that has stopped functioning. We will come back to that chirp, because at the 12-minute mark of this investigation, that sound is going to be the reason a man spends the rest of his life in a 6x9 cell. The luminal spray hits the walls of the hallway, and the house begins to glow a ghostly neon blue. The patterns are not random splashes. They are directional. We see the spray across the baseboards, the fine misting on the underside of the hallway table. This is high-velocity impact spatter. In forensic terms, this means a force, a bullet, a hammer, a blade, struck a source of liquid blood with enough energy to atomize it. We calculate the angle of incidence. The droplets are elongated, like tiny exclamation points, pointing back to the source. The source was kneeling. The source was begging. As the technicians measure the diameter of the stains, a pattern emerges, a void in the spatter. A human-shaped shadow on the wall where no blood landed. This tells us someone was standing between the victim and the wall. Someone who walked away, covered in the evidence the room is trying to screen. I want you to stop and look at your own front door right now. Think about the deadbolt. You think it keeps the world out. But what if the deadbolt is actually keeping you in? We like to believe that evil has a specific face, a jagged, recognizable snarl. But the most dangerous people in your life are the ones who know exactly how you take your coffee. They are the ones who know your favorite song, your deepest fear, and the exact moment you fall into a deep sleep. As we move through this evidence, I want you to ask yourself, if the person sitting across from you right now decided to erase you, how many hours would pass before anyone even noticed you were gone? The master bedroom is a freezer. The air conditioner is cranked down to 55 degrees, a common tactic used to delay the onset of rigor mortis and decomposition. The bed is made with military precision. The hospital corners are tight enough to bounce a quarter off. But the smell is something the cold can't fully hide. It is the scent of copper mixed with expensive French perfume, and something else, something sweet and rotting, like overripe peaches in the sun. We pull back the duvet. There is no body, only a massive dark stain that has soaked through the mattress, the topper, and into the wooden frame itself. The volume of blood here is approximately 2 liters. The human body holds 5. The math is simple and devastating. Whoever was in this bed didn't just bleed, they were drained. The investigation shifts to the digital footprint. We are analyzing the router logs. At 3:14 a.m., the home's Wi-Fi network registered a new device, not a phone, not a laptop, a smart plug located in the basement. This plug was activated for exactly 12 minutes. Why would a killer stop to turn on a lamp in the cellar? We head downstairs. The basement is dry, finished, and smells of laundry detergent. We find the plug. It's connected to a chest freezer. But when we open the freezer, it's empty. Just frost and the smell of ozone. We look closer at the floor. There are 4 small, circular indentations in the linoleum, as if something incredibly heavy sat there for a short time and was then dragged toward the back exit. We follow the drag marks. They lead to the sump pump. We are kneeling by the sump pump now. The plastic lid is cracked. Using a fiber optic camera, we lower a lens into the dark, murky water of the basin. The water is stagnant. We see a flash of something white. A bone? No, it's a piece of plastic. A zip tie. Then we see it. A small black plastic bag, weighted down with a single paving stone. As the hook brings the bag to the surface, the chirp from the smoke detector upstairs goes off again. It's louder down here, more resonant. We realize the sound isn't coming from a smoke detector at all. It's coming from inside the bag. Inside that black plastic, we find a burner phone, wrapped in a waterproof casing. The battery is at 1%. The phone is receiving a continuous stream of incoming calls from a private number, but it's the outgoing data that stops the investigation cold. This phone wasn't used to call a co-conspirator. It was used to broadcast. For 3 hours on the night of the disappearance, this phone was live streaming a private encrypted feed to a server based in Eastern Europe. The corp wasn't a low battery, it was a connection alert. Every time the signal dipped, the phone emitted that sharp digital cry. The killer didn't just commit a murder, they sold tickets to it. The technical analysis of the stream's metadata provides a timestamp that shatters the husband's alibi. He claimed to be at a hotel 3 states away, but the IP address used to log into the broadcast's admin panel was assigned to the hotel's business center at the exact moment the stream went live. We are looking at the digital breadcrumbs of a man who thought he was a ghost. He used a VPN, but he forgot the most basic rule of digital forensics: every connection leaves a handshake. We have the handshake. We have the motive: a $3 million life insurance policy with a double indemnity clause for accidental death. But there was nothing accidental about this. Now, look at the gold ring again, the one found on the counter, the one that was surgically clean. When we put that ring under a scanning electron microscope, we find the Johnny Walker element. Inside the band, where the jeweler's hallmark is stamped, there is a microscopic fragment of a blue latex glove. This tells us the person who placed the ring was wearing protection. They wanted the scene to look like a symbolic leaving, a dramatic exit of a disgruntled wife. But they were too careful. In their effort to leave a clean scene, they left the one thing that proves premeditation. They didn't just find the ring. They cleaned it, polished it, and staged it while her blood was still warm on their shoes. We are watching the interrogation tapes now. The husband sits in a metal chair, his hands folded. He is wearing a blue sweater, the sleeves pushed up to reveal tan, athletic forearms. He is crying, but there are no tears. His breath is shallow. He is performing grief, the way a bad actor performs Shakespeare. All noise and no soul. The lead detective slides the photo of the blue latex fragment across the table. The husband doesn't look at the photo. He looks at the detective's eyes. This is a classic dominance display in forensic psychology. He is checking to see if the lie landed. When the detective mentions the live stream, the husband's left eyelid flinches, just once. A micro expression lasting less than a 20th of a second. It is the sound of a trap snapping shut. The case of the Sycamore House isn't just a story of a bad marriage. It's a story about the absolute erosion of the human spirit in the face of greed. The body was never found. The theory is that the weight in the chest freezer wasn't the victim, but a series of industrial acid baths used to liquefy the remains before they were disposed of in a nearby chemical runoff. The husband was convicted on circumstantial evidence and the digital handshake, but he still maintains his innocence from behind bars. He writes letters every week, claiming that he was framed by a digital entity he met on the dark web. So, here is the question that has divided the legal community for 3 years. If a person is murdered, but there is no body, no weapon, and the only evidence is a series of zeros and ones on a server that no longer exists, is the conviction a triumph of modern technology, or is it a dangerous precedent that allows the state to imprison anyone based on a digital ghost? Is he a monster who sold his wife's final moments for profit, or is he the victim of a sophisticated frame-up that we are all too eager to believe because it fits a narrative? The comments are going to be a war zone on this one. Which side of the glass are you on?